Good morning. Todd Zwillick with you in for John Hockenberry this week. A look this morning at Libya, where there are few foreign journalists. This is Sarah in Tripoli, a resident of Tripoli, speaking to our partner, the BBC. Listen.
We can't even talk to us. They want to shoot us because they know that Tripoli is very important. Like, our capital, Trablus, is very important. If he loses Tripoli, then he lost. The whole regime is gone.
There are reports that the eastern city of Benghazi has been under the control of protesters and maybe certain elements of the army who are helping them. To be honest, we really don't know. These are unconfirmed reports. And that some of these, unrest has spread to Tripoli late yesterday, as you just heard. Human Rights Watch reports that at least 233 people are dead as a result of the clashes, probably more in clashes in Tripoli today. Joining us is David Kirkpatrick, Cairo Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. He's been reporting on the political unrest in Libya. David, good morning.
Good morning.
David, unconfirmed reports late last night that Muammar Gaddafi has left the country. What do we know now? Is he in country or out of country, or do we know?
Well, only Gaddafi knows for sure, but my latest intelligence is that there are still guards loyal to Gaddafi guarding the presidential palace, which tells me that Gaddafi has not left the building. And when his son spoke on television this morning at 1 a.m. Cairo, Tripoli time, he said they weren't going anywhere. I think his words were, we're going to fight until the last man, the last woman, the last bullet. So if Gaddafi was meanwhile boarding a plane, that would be a surprise.
David, how are you getting your information? We know that there are very few, if any, foreign journalists in Libya. Internet lockdown, television lockdown. We're relying on sat phone reports. How are you getting your information?
Sat phone reports, telephone reports. You can still reach people in Libya by phone. Sometimes they relay messages to expats in the West who then help us get in touch with their numbers. They change phones a lot so that the security forces don't nab them, except in the parts of the country that the revolutionaries, uprising has taken over, and then they don't fear that threat anymore. So the information is sketchy. When you get somebody, I try to talk with them as much as I can because you never know when you're going to get them back again.
Well, David Kirkpatrick of the New York Times, fact check some of what I'm hearing for me, if you would. Even Gaddafi's son admits that Benghazi is now in the hands of the protesters. We've heard that they have actually taken control of some weapons from military sites and even tanks. We've also heard Al Jazeera's reporting that there is heavy gunfire in Tripoli today, that 61 people have been killed, and that some of the protesters expect protesters in Benghazi to come and help them in Tripoli. Are you hearing those things as well?
Should I take this point by point? I don't think that Gaddafi's son acknowledged that the protesters had taken any cities. I think that's not an accurate depiction of the speech. I think what happened in Benghazi is a troop of reinforcements arrived, and they turned against the other army units and in support of the people, and that's the people of Benghazi. And that's what allowed the uprising to take control of the city. And that is worth dwelling on for another minute, because it points to the unusual nature of the Libyan military. The military is itself organized along quasi-tribal lines. You can't speak of a sort of unified military command the way we think of when we use the word military, which poses a big risk going ahead. I mean, what we've seen in Tunis and in Egypt is, when push comes to shove between the ruler and the unhappy people, the military steps in to mediate and says, okay, it's time now for you to go. We're going to take over. I don't think that's likely to happen in Libya, which makes it sort of a wild card. Shooting in Tripoli, yeah.
Well, it sounds like we may have lost David Kirkpatrick from Cairo. Let's move on now to Nick Kristof, columnist for The New York Times, who has been giving us regular updates from Manama in Bahrain. Nick, good morning.
Good morning.
Nick, thanks for joining us once again. We're happy to have you. Protesters camping out right in the Pearl Roundabout in the symbolic center of Manama. What is the latest on the relationship or discussions or negotiations between the protesters and the government there?
Well, yeah, the Pearl Roundabout is just remarkable to look at these days. It's It's just growing, spilling well beyond the roundout with just hundreds and hundreds of tents and, you know, all kinds of sort of services. There's a bit of a museum of government atrocities. There's lots of restaurants with free food. And there's a barber where I actually got my haircut yesterday. But the underlying issue is that there's a huge gap between what those protesters want and what the government is willing to offer. And the protesters want some sign, various concessions, before they agree to a full-fledged dialogue. And, you know, not least they want the ouster of a number of key ministers, including the prime minister, who has been around for 40 years as prime minister and is a member of the ruling family. And it's not clear that the ruling family is willing to give that up or to release political prisoners. And the plans to protest seem to be getting bigger and bigger. There were more marches today. A major one is planned for tomorrow. An exile opposition leader may be returning tomorrow. So there's a lot of tension there and a lot of fear among the protesters that the government is again going to decide, well, enough is enough, and turn to violence.
Nick, I don't want to make you too much of the story here, but you said you got a haircut yesterday. The internet is a buzz, and I saw on Twitter that members of the royal family would like to give you a cut on other places around your head, not your hair. You become part of the story in Bahrain. What's the reaction to threats placed upon you by the royals?
Well, I mean, this is actually just sort of fascinating to me, and I guess it's a tribute to the power of Twitter. Because I mean, I've been in places where people certainly read the New York Times and have, you know, reactions, positive or negative, to what I've written. But in Bahrain, because the local media just don't provide much coverage. So the way Bahrainis themselves find out what's happening around them is through their Twitter feeds. And so you have a large number of people here who essentially their news diet is based on Twitter. And so when I arrived, they began to follow me, and then that triggered huge debates about whether I was you know, the best thing since sliced bread or the most evil person around. And so I've the royal family has indeed
come out against you, Nick. Let's leave it there for the moment, Nick. Let's not put too fine a point on it, but to say that there were tweets that members of the royal family would like a knife to get close to your neck. Nick, stay safe. Nicholas Kristof, columnist for our partner, the New York Times, in Manama with another update. Nick, thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.